Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
We're still in Black History Month.
Yes.
And so we did older black churches. We did a really beautiful send up for HBCUs.
Woo!
And so this week we're talking about us.
Yes.
We're talking about us and our contributions to this country in ways that sometimes go unnoticed, and we're going to try to put them perspectives together.
Yeah.
For see where we land, because we think that we've been saving this country for a while.
And have.
So let's talk about it.
Yes, let's talk about it. So just in general, you know, I think that people don't always look at our community as the linchpin that it really is, but there are some significant events and experiences that are attributable to black people standing in the gap for America, either by force or by choice, but definitely standing in the gap for her. So we just want to highlight a few of these things, and by no means is this list exhaustive.
Oh,
no, because every day we get new examples. So what we got?
All right, so times when black people saved us.
Times where black people saved us. So let's just look, you know, first of all, the establishment of what became America. We built the American economy. We built ourselves up as a world power. And directly, black people are involved in that. The free labor system allowed for a huge accumulation of wealth that we still haven't overcome.
Allows.
Yes. Well, I said allowed because where I'm...
Right, but if your jeans cost under $20, it allows. It's still happening.
True. It allows for this accumulation of wealth that still is inequitable. We don't have equal access to the wealth that we create. But nonetheless, we are responsible for billions of dollars in fiscal activity. And that is important. We are the backbone of this economy.
It was built on blood and bodies. So the African slaves, through our labor, through our physical labor, the labor of black women.
Mm-hmm. Especially black women.
Right. Through laboring to produce children, other black people, children of slave masters, basically growing slaves. Like we've done this work. We've talked about this. So yes, right. we've done a lot of work in that area. So,
and people need to understand that, you know, even through the Civil War, the South was only able to secede. It was only able to even entertain becoming its own country because of the slave economy, because of the amount of wealth it had. The nuances of the war, you hear people say, oh, states' rights, you know, sectionalism, whatever. The South wouldn't have even been entertained on the world stage without the strength of its economy, which is why when slaves were freed, that was more so a war tactic, an economic tactic, much like a blockade, than act of compassion.
Right. So that was the time we saved the colonies or the experiment. So we also remember that time we saved the republic or the democracy.
Democracy itself.
So the United States operated as a British colony. And there was a moment where we decided to break away from that colonial rule and said, okay, so we have the American Revolution. Fugitive slaves fought in the American Revolution.
Yeah.
The first person who died in the American Revolution was Crispus Attucks.
Yep. In Boston.
So we're there the whole way.
We're there. And we're actively critiquing, you know, the presence of two minds, that America herself could be free without the occupants of the land all being free. So we're not only saving the democracy, but we're also critiquing its early coming together. What type of nation do you want to be? And that question persists today. What type of nation do you want to be? So literally the soul of America is the soul of black folk.
So we're fighting for freedom and not free. And that equity or that inequity still persists. And so that's a battle that we constantly fight to pull this democracy in the right direction.
Right.
Our existence is constantly reminding the country that we're not there yet.
Right.
And so that shows up in different ways.
Yeah.
It shows up in equal rights amendments and things like that.
The reflection of our condition, definitely.
So remember the time we saved white women who drew affirmative action?
Oh my goodness.
So.
Yes, actually. Affirmative action, as it was designed in the 70s, was really to build a door for white women to participate in the economy and to earn healthier wages, to have more access to leadership opportunities, and to generally gain, you know, by pushing them through the door, it's like the coalition that was able to press for affirmative action laws included people that we're not always sure at the intersection of race and gender whether or not white women are overly concerned whether or not everybody else who qualifies for affirmative action gets through that same door. But for sure, they have been the largest beneficiaries of a program that has been misconstrued to seem that only benefits people of color or only benefits black people. That's just not true.
Yeah. So, I mean, 1995, California did a study where they were looking at the effects of affirmative action. Mm-hmm. And they found that white women had benefited to the tune of 57,000 jobs mm-hmm. compared to the other groups where black people had 10,500 jobs, Latinos 19,000 jobs, Asian Americans 24,000 jobs. Mm-hmm. And these were due to the changes that came as a result of affirmative action. Also, between the years of 1970 and 2002, due to affirmative action, the percentage of women physicians tripled from 7.6% to 25.2%. Mm-hmm. And so these changes that produced a documented increase in the employability of women mm-hmm. and benefit of women are due to what was perceived as a change to target black Americans.
Exactly. But the fact that that doesn't always show up in the in the results data, that black people have benefited to the same extent that they are often centered in an affirmative action conversation. It's just a distortion of the reality that the biggest beneficiaries of the program may or may not see the value, again, because of the intersection between race and gender. They might be walking through the door and closing the door behind them. Mm-hmm. And that's a constant concern. You know, black women are the highest educated group in the country. We are entering college at a higher level than most of our counterparts. We're carrying a lion's share of college debt, whatever. We're also making strides in organizations. But one of the critiques about black women being or appearing to be more active in organizations is this idea of a dual tokenism, being both black and female. Her presence is overstated in an organization's makeup mm-hmm. where it's not proportional to the qualifications, nor is it proportional to the actual open slots for those manager or higher positions. It's something that has to be constantly monitored mm-hmm. because it can be distorted at the drop of a hat.
Yeah. And in keeping with the time we saved the democracy, remember that time when black women saved Alabama from
itself? From itself.
So Roy Moore almost won the Senate seat in Alabama.
Yeah.
If it weren't for the 97% of black women who
were not having it. Yeah. And that block, that voting block, over 90% or over 94% has shown up in major elections. So the exit data, even from the 2016 election, looks like that. Black women voting one particular way to the tune of, I believe, 94%. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just because you understand when you are the furthest behind, you get to see the whole field. Mm-hmm. And if you want something to work out for you and it has to trickle all the way down,
yeah.
you tend to vote collectively or show up collectively, moving in strength in numbers. So I'm always glad to see that when it matters, we press through as a homogenous group, not homogenous thought, but it's almost like a sixth purpose, sense purpose. That we know, yeah, this is not what we play with. We don't play with our ability to be represented and have our interests represented, knowing that if we move up, that means everybody else did.
Mm-hmm. It was that time we saved Hollywood.
So how do we save Hollywood?
Okay, so leading up to the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. Hollywood productions had become much more lavish. So you think about Elizabeth Taylor's Cleopatra.
Yes.
It's a $44 million budget. It's no special effects. There's nothing there that's warranting that much.
Right.
I mean, the production did, it was a high production cost, but after the war, these lavish films were no longer in vogue. And mm-hmm. so there was more fiscal responsibility in how we approach things. And so then you enter these smaller black films like Ozzie Davis's Cotton Comes to Harlem in 1969, Melvin Van Peebles' Sweetback's Badass Song, and things like that. So you start to get smaller films that start to actually draw an audience. This is a black audience now because we're not looking at Yul Brynner and Errol Flynn and people like that. Also, what's contributing to this Hollywood salvation is white flight. So after the war, white people started to migrate to rural areas from the urban
and suburban areas.
Right. Mm-hmm. So black people started to move in to all of these. And this is how we still get older generations still referring to the inner cities as black, because there were times when black people were starting to move into these cities.
Right.
And they just haven't outgrown that language. But as black people enter these metropolitan areas, they start to spend their money at the cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And so this gives rise to blaxploitation in the 70s.
Right.
And so this becomes another niche. And so filmmaking is starting to change.
Right. But much like with anything in pop culture that's hot, in culture writ large, now you have a Black is Beautiful movement. You have a something that is being represented as a Black Power movement. There are things happening in the country that Hollywood, being a pulse point, being a reflection, they're going to want to participate in. The problem with blaxploitation, the good thing about it is that these are, to some extent, Black stories, but they are not exclusive of, let's say, editing or writing or other creative input that benefits from stereotypes as opposed to, you know, real life or respectable depiction. So you take the good with the bad, but there are people that we call Black famous. So we ended up having more faces and more people to look up to in film and eventually in TV, launching great careers because these movies are now making it to market. So there's this growing valuation for the Black audience who wants to see Black people on film.
Yeah, I mean, we hadn't seen it. We hadn't seen ourselves before on that large screen. And whether you start out in this kind of campy version of Black culture that didn't really exist. I mean, Black people aren't around doing karate all the time and all of that stuff. Like, it's not that, but you still launch the careers of Pam Grier and Richard Roundtree. And you got all of these people who have these long careers in acting because of this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the precursor to modern Black filmmaking.
Right.
So then that kind of dies off. And then in the 90s, you start to get this resurgence of Black filmmakers, starting with Spike Lee. Spike Lee introducing something new to filmmaking, because now he's starting to communicate what's going on in Black life to Black people.
Yeah.
So where blaxploitation was for consumption of anyone who went to the movies, primarily Black people who were in the cities, Spike Lee is talking to Black people in the white gaze. So he's signifying things that Black people know in front of white people who may not pick it up. And so as you're watching, let's say Do the Right Thing or whatever, and bugging out, Giancarlo Espinoso's character is talking to Sal. And he's like, you know, Sal, we ain't got no brothers up on the wall, you know. And so they start to have this whole, this becomes the arc of the movie.
Right.
And we're seeing that the signifying is this white business is in this black community drawing all of this money from Black people and not respecting their humanity enough to even put them on the wall. Sounds like when you get your own piece of shop, you can put whoever you want on the wall. I have an Italian shop. I'm putting Italian people on the wall. And so Spike Lee is issuing commentary to the Black community like, wait, in his first four films, Wake Up is the call of all four films. And Do the Right Thing, those are the first words in the movie. The Samuel Jackson's character says in School Days, they're the last words in the movie.
Right.
These words occur at different points. And so you have this genre of Black filmmaking that's speaking to Black people. And so now we're starting to do some stuff. Then you get John Singleton. Then you get all of these filmmakers leading all the way up to the current group of Jordan Peele's and Ava DuVernay's. And so Black people are issuing commentary in the same way hip hop does.
Yeah.
Say, this is what's going on. This is what we need to be talking about. So we moved away from the kitschy blaxploitation films and actually contributing to the dialogue of the country.
Exactly. We always talk about having a seat at the table, definitely through art and music and film. we began to see the value of creating our own table. And that was really not a new idea in the 90s, 2000s, the Master P's and people who said, oh, let me have my own labels or let me create my own films. It's actually a throwback to having our own record labels and this Motown idea and Stax, these labels that came out primarily to give Black artists a vehicle to get their art out. Mm-hmm. So it goes from being, oh, I'm just participating in this industry, to I am critiquing Black life for Black consumption. And this industry becomes the vessel. So because, you know, now we understand it's not so much even just writing, it's retaining the rights. It's making sure you have your publishing. It is making sure you have ownership.
Mm-hmm.
So we have modern examples that I think are drawing from, again, the times where we did it the first time, mm-hmm. you know, prior to integration, and we had our own, and then saw the values change, you know, whether those things were eaten up or having to be integrated. We still see the value in us owning the platforms that allow us to say what we want to say and depict ourselves the way we want to see ourselves depicted, i.e. Tyler Perry's whole little mini city mm-hmm. in Atlanta. You know, you might not agree with the scripts or the wigs, but he yeah. is a powerhouse
yep.
Because he has focused not only on the product, but also the ownership.
Yep. All right. So we also save comics. This is me.
this your is, angle, all of that.
Yeah, I'm always going to throw some nerd shit in there. So the golden age of comics in the 60s were very white.
And okay.
So you had Superman, you had Batman. They came out with something that they thought would save their dwindling sales, which is Spider-Man. Spider-Man was good because Spider-Man spoke to teenagers.
Uh-huh.
And so that changed the demographic of who was buying comics. So now they're like, okay, this guy's like you. He's in high school. He's smart. He mm-hmm. has powers. So Spider-Man did. And so then that started to fall off. Then they had teams like the Fantastic Four and the Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, they're starting to switch around Avengers because they can't. It doesn't really click. And so this industry doesn't really know what to do into the X-Men.
Okay.
All right. So the X-Men, it's debatable, but you get this juxtaposition between a pacifist, who is Charles Xavier, who's the leader of the X-Men, and then a militant, who is Magneto, leader of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. They're friends. They have the same purpose. They want to advance mutants or reduce discrimination against mutants, but they mm-hmm. have different ways of wanting to go about it. Very much like Martin Luther King and
right,
Malcolm X.
Right.
And so the X-Men storyline is propelled by this social justice movement that's going around in real life that's saying Black people are fighting for equality.
Right.
But in the comics, the mutants are fighting mm-hmm. for equality. And you see the same type of discrimination. People are holding the signs. And while these mutants are dealing with all of this backlash against their existence, they're saving the world. Like, they're saving people over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And so that idea was powerful enough to start to move Marvel Comics into a different sphere, because now instead of having a team that they don't really know what to do with in the Avengers, and then another one that people don't really connect with in the Fantastic Four, they have this group of mutants, their kids, that people identify with, and they can keep bringing new people in, and
mm-hmm.
and it just works. And so X-Men becomes the flagship franchise for Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you're welcome for monetizing our struggle and saving your industry. I don't know. Do we need to talk about music? Y'all know what we do.
And that's it.
Yeah. All of the music. you're welcome.
Like, no, you're welcome.
Rock and roll.
Yeah.
Jazz. Everything. All of it.
Everything. All of it. And I guess that is it.
Yeah. I mean, we've saved your music industry many times with our
numerous
creativity.
Times. We've also disrupted it. Like, I know y'all are annoyed with how artists are now, not even y'all, because that's not even the goal. Not only have we saved these industries, but we've disrupted them. And I speak of her often, but I love the way that Beyonce just drops projects seemingly out of the sky. But the quality of the project lets you know that so much has gone into their preparation. But definitely when she dropped Self-Title in 2013,
mm-hmm.
she kind of turned the paradigm on its head. She has not gone back to marketing. She has not gone back to announcing, you know, something's coming out. later on. Only because The Lion King was on screen did people know that something was coming. But I don't even think they anticipated what they got when it came to this soundtrack, where, again, intentionally, we were just talking about building bridges offline, but she built a bridge between the fact that she, as a Black American artist, is going to bring all of her star power to that project, but also use that same star power to give opening to artists from Africa who otherwise might not be on that project. I mean, and even when you go back to the old Lion King, you had some small examples of traditional music, but not to the level, I think, of this modern interpretation of their soundtrack. So, and that's just a small example.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a good example because similar to the way Spike Lee speaks directly to Black people, Beyonce is also doing the same. As she's matured in her career or evolved in her career, she's speaking to us. White gaze is there. And what you're talking about in terms of the marketing is so effective that Eminem just dropped an album. Same way. No information about it. The album just came out. It just showed up one day. So whether people love or hate Eminem, Eminem has sold 150 million albums. That is an incredible amount of albums. He should be able to put out just a tweet to say this album's on the way and people going to get ready. They're going to start salivating. But he's following the Beyonce model to do that. Contrast that with when Apple tried to force everyone to get their U2 album. We hated it. Everyone hated it. You can't do that to us. But like, what is this crap on my phone?
Right.
Like, I didn't want this. I didn't want Bono on my phone. So Beyonce is actually doing something different. Okay, so that's how we save comedy. This is important for stand-up comics and just comedy in general. So when I was young, I would always watch stand-up comedy.
Yeah,
you watch the little improv things and you see, you know, Ellen DeGeneres and Paula Poundstone. And
Michael, or if you watch Showtime at the Apollo, a lot of our comics would be there.
But those were the formats that we could get comedy. Like, it was a little bit here and there in between shows and things like that. Eddie Murphy comes and does Delirious. And Delirious is so successful, he follows that up with Raw at Madison Square Garden. And he ends up selling out Madison Square Garden and breaking this record. I believe the record was 150 million in sales. This is a theatrical release of a comedy special. This is huge. People are going to the movies to see this guy on stage at a comedy special.
Right.
After that, you get Def Comedy Jam. Def Comedy Jam is a weekly comedy special highlighting Black comics. And this is some of the most outrageous comedy that you could see, but they're the most talented people. This is where you get your Chris Tuckers and your Bernie Macs and your Martin Lawrence. You get Chris Rock. Everyone that came through comedy between the 90s and now came through Def Comedy Jam.
Yep.
And there wasn't a show that did this. There wasn't a show that worked in this format. But it had a huge audience every week, and it broke all of the careers. This is Black people doing this. Then you had the Kings of Comedy.
Kings of Comedy was the jam.
So Kings of Comedy ends up being a featured length
stand-up
comedy movie.
Yep.
And comics are living and eating off the work that these Black comics are doing. I mean, you even see now Kevin Hart's doing the same thing. He just recently broke Eddie Murphy's record last year. But that is something that did not exist until we did it. If it weren't for that, you would be seeing Sam Kinison and, you know, great comics. Andrew Dice Clay.
Right. So it would exist, but I also want to go back just a little bit further, even beyond Eddie, because Eddie's example was Red Fox
and Richard Pryor,
who put out albums. And I know, because I used to listen to those albums when I wasn't supposed to.
Yeah.
But again, it was even on those albums, which brought the comedy out of the comedy club and allowed you to take it home and consume it whenever you could, as opposed to, oh, I got to make plans or see if you're going to be on tour. The Chitlin circuit very much so still exists to some extent at this point. But those albums that brought that comedic relief and also that, I want to call it like a sweet sadness, because here are Black comics commenting on Black life and how we could laugh to keep from crying. That was the basis of what then became Delirious and Raw. And as we again open up these doors and these platforms, right alongside you have black women comics doing the same thing, because it's a Queens of Comedy, and
you got Monique doing this, having just as huge a career as anyone else in the business. You got Adele Givens, huge run in the 90s.
Some more.
It's a lot of talented black women comics.
So I just wanted to make sure we made that.
So we saved an industry that didn't really know how to monetize itself, and we showed them.
The hustle.
All right.
Huh.
let's do this one quick.
Okay.
That's how we save Western Christianity from itself.
I mean, because we was tired.
All right. So faith in North America had been monopolized by European theology. So your Karl Barths, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Paul Tillich, a lot of names that, you know, most people, I guess average people wouldn't know, but they're influencing the theology that's making into your churches.
Right.
And so Christianity was pretty white, you know, it had gone through colonization and all of these manifestations that it contributed to, slavery, all of it.
Right.
Until the civil rights movement starts in the 60s. And then James Cone, who was a young theologian, a seminarian at the time, drops a meteor on the world with Black Liberation Theology, or Black Theology and Black Power is the book, and becomes the father of Black Liberation Theology. After that, you get a critique of his theology saying, by black women saying, well, your theology doesn't have room for us.
Right.
So you get Dolores Williams and Renita Weems and Katie Cannon and a group of womanist theologians that expand that view. Then you get another set of LGBTQ or queer theologians that come and say, well, you know, you still, and they critique womanist theologians like Kelly Brown Douglas, and they say, well, this is important. So, for instance, you got Roger Sneed, who will be on the show next week. But you have theology starting to grow, and it is through all of these lenses that Christianity is like, wait a minute, we didn't even think of it this way.
Right. And because they didn't have to.
They didn't have a lens for it. And so now that this scholarship is happening, people are starting to consider how they move differently, how their faith works differently. Dolores Williams, a very brilliant theologian, one of her major contributions was, we talked about previously, surrogacy, and how surrogacy impacts specifically black women, and how the theology of surrogacy, or the suffering servant, is dangerous and has been dangerous. So that takes the salvific work of Jesus down from the cross and says, no, it's not there. It's in the ministry of Jesus, the liberating ministry of Jesus, where Jesus is elevating women and elevating the poor and the sick. And what happens on the cross is the political response to doing the good work. And so that's a huge move in theology, because the cross has always been the symbol. But if the cross is the symbol of divine punishment or divine violence, that just perpetuates violence or the nobility of suffering for people who are already suffering.
Right.
She says you can't do that. And Christianity's like, oh, wow, we didn't think of that. Just the same way they did with James Cone. Like, oh, wow, I didn't think
that. I also think, just to link it all together, though, like, we have the presence, this emergence of a black church that has not been legitimized in these academic spaces either. So almost like it's just happening, because this is how the black people are getting together, or have been allowed to get together around their faith expressions. So James Cone doesn't drop the meteor without the small pebbles that came together with the existence of these black churches that are existing and persisting in spite of, which means that there is something at work within even our churches and how our churches represent whatever section of Christianity we might be in. So it's not so much that you had Baptist churches, but what is it about the Black Baptist experience that needs to be captured, quantified, explained, delivered, consumed? What is it about the AME church? What is it about Black Catholics? What is it about the existence of Black Lutherans, Black Presbyterians, Black Methodists, or the lack thereof? Like, what is happening there? So we end up being a huge part of, when you say saving, it's like our existence in this space is the surgery to help heal, because it's not the cancer. It's a part of the surgery to help heal it overall. So it's like we recognize that something exists that would almost want to maim the body of Christ. Mm-hmm. There's something in there. We've tried to identify it, but Cone leaving women out is but a or us realizing that he did not yet include them. They had not yet been included in this expansion of liberation theology. Has more to do with him opening the door, not being mindful of whether or not it closes behind him. Mm-hmm. Women opening in, you know, black women and women of color. And these two terms are not interchangeable. Opening the door with intention and making sure it doesn't close behind them. The idea that black queer theologians come and open that door with intention. And who knows what comes next. But it is happening because obviously there's enough presence of purpose and presence of progress that we don't intend for a cancer to exist mm-hmm. that we're not going to treat, or for brokenness to exist that we're not going to allow to be healed, exposed and healed. Sometimes when a bone is broken, it has to be reset. And the resetting is just as painful as the breaking. Mm. That time we save Christianity from healing a broken bone in an ineffective, unusable way.
The reason why we know we need saving in a lot of ways is because we observe the cancer, mm-hmm. to use your analogy. Like, we know it's there. We as black people show it's there.
Yep.
We show that you think you're fine and you probably are fine, white person. But what's happening over here to all these other people is not fine.
Not okay.
So that means we as a collective are not fine.
Yeah.
That is the thing that needs to be addressed. And oh, by the way, here are some ideas about how to make it fine.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you don't like those ideas? Here are some more ideas about how to make it fine. And so that's the tension that's occurring. And mm-hmm. that's how we end up in these salvific places where we can say, all right, you don't like those suggestions? I'm going to go do it myself, and yep. I'm going to start Cadillac Records, and I'm going to do all of these things until you understand that there's value in this,
right.
that you have reached your ceiling if you just consider yourself mm-hmm. and not everyone else. But if we do the thing that's making everyone whole, then our ceiling just elevates so much higher.
Yeah, that's usually where the battle is fought.
And so black people have been doing that since we arrived in this country in different ways. Mm-hmm. And we've been doing that under the specter of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
So I sit back and I marvel and I say, well, we are the heroes. Like, we have been.
Literally.
Even though we carry this burden that we can't shake, it's Superman running with one leg. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's still Superman. He's still probably pretty fast.
Right.
But if he had two legs, oh my God.
Right.
And so with us, just the ability to be able to think through what that would look like if we didn't have this obstacle that we had to constantly contend with, how much more effective would we be? How much more would we be able to elevate the collective? We will explore that next week as we go into Afrofuturism, and we will talk about that.
Yes, we will.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.